welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and it is May the 18th, 2013, as I record this at episode 156 of the podcast. And remember, you can get all the backlist at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. So today's episode is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment with audiobooks. And today we are delving deep into writing character with the brilliant Roz Morris, author of 13 novels, who blogs at nailyournovel.com. And we discuss all the things authors get wrong, as well as how you can craft characters your readers will want more of. And we do get into a really good conversation about some of the, you know, deeper aspects of writing character, you know, including how that develops with your writing over time. But first, a little update from me. So exciting news, I finished the rewrites of Desecration, my crime thriller set in London with themes of dissection, body modification and corpse art. My description changes every time, I realise that, and I'm working on it. But it is dark and twisty indeed, although it is, you know, also a straight crime thriller and whodunit mystery type of thing. But anyway, it's with my agent in New York and goes out on submission next week, which is quite exciting about that. So we'll see what happens. And it's funny, I really only feel this kind of occasionally a tiny twinge of excitement or something. Like, it's not the sort of hyper excited that I'm sure some people get, but it's more like, I think I know so much now about the realities of the publishing industry that I'm trying to keep my expectations very low. Obviously, I hope to get an amazing editor with a brilliant publisher who wants to be a true partner in connecting my work to readers, so I can become a hybrid author and take over the world or something like that. But, you know, or at least reach some more people with my stories. But hey, we'll just have to see. I mean, maybe we'll talk about this on another show, you know, the kind of the self-publishing balance. But certainly I'm so entrepreneurial and, you know, I love doing these things myself that it will be a very interesting experience for me doing things with a publisher. So part of me just wants to do it for that reason. But I also am really proud of this book. I think it's certainly the best thing I've written so far. And it's really, I think I'm finding my voice. So I'm very excited about it. But anyway, if the right deal doesn't come along, I am committing to self-publishing it by Christmas. And then I'll be starting the next one, Delirium, quite soon, after I finish some other outstanding projects. So on that, I am in the, I've just gone over the 70,000 word mark on a book on book marketing, which is hilarious. It started out as, you know, I've got this blog and all these people ask me questions every day. I get emails asking me about how to do book marketing. And so I wanted to have, you know, a book that collected everything in, you know, rather than just sending people to articles around the blog. And what's hilarious is it's turned into something a lot bigger than that. So, you know, if you have a small business or if you're a speaker or if you're a fiction or non-fiction author, there's kind of everything in it. And it's based around my philosophy of marketing, which is very much to be authentic and use attraction marketing and, you know like and trust and all of those types of things. So it should be out in June. So I hope you're going to be interested in that. But the man who influenced me probably the most in terms of marketing is Seth Godin, who I'm sure many of you know. And his amazing blog and his books continue to inspire me all the time. I'm you know, total fan of his. And his most recent book is The Icarus Deception, How High Will You Fly? Which will seriously kick your ass about your creative life and your, you know, challenge you to achieve Save More and Pick Yourself, and it's really well worth reading. It is available on Audible as an audiobook, as well as obviously print and ebooks. And excitingly, today's show is sponsored by Audible, and you can get a free audiobook, so you can pick up Seth Godin's Icarus Deception, and a 30-day trial today by signing up at audiblepodcast.com/thecreativepen, and that's pen with a double N. So yeah, you could get Seth Godin or another book. I mean, a lot of his books are on Audible, a whole stack of them, and this is definitely how I changed my life when I was working a job full time, as I listened, and I still listen to a lot of audio. I find, especially when you're doing chores or at the gym, you know, on the go, on the commute, whatever, you know, when you're reading, when your eyes are really tired from screens, audiobooks are fantastic. So yeah, check out Seth Godin's Icarus Deception or any other book on audiblepodcast.com/thecreativepen to get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial. Pentecost will also be in the Audible store in the next 7 to 10 days, so hopefully I will advertise that in the next show, which is very exciting. And all the other Arcane books will also be on audio in the next few months, so yeah, exciting times. Okay, let's get on with the interview with Roz. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Roz Morris. Hi Roz.
Hi Joanna.
Great to have you back on the show. So just a little introduction. Roz is the author of over a dozen novels as a ghostwriter and has also written Memories of a Future Life under her own name. She has a series of books for writers. The first one is Nail Your Novel, which we've talked about before. And her latest is Bring Your Characters to Life, which we're talking about today. So, Roz, you know, exciting. I was just saying to you before we started recording, you know, how big this book is. It's seriously chunky. You know, what's all that about? Are characters really that important?
Well, they are, because there are two things to a book, really. You've got plot, which is certainly necessary. You've got to feel the characters will do something that is going to interest you, and that it's going to be a tale worth telling. But part of the reason it's interesting is who it's happening to. So you might have murders and natural disasters or events that make us wonder, how will they get out of that? But that's intellectual curiosity. If you've got a story about a natural disaster, you've got plenty of drama, you've got problems to solve, but it doesn't really come alive until you put yourself in somebody's shoes who's actually there. So if you've got a story about a tsunami, you see someone being swept away and she's just a matchstick on the tide, but if she was on the way to her wedding, then she's suddenly a person with a life and hopes, and we care that the disaster took that away. We're immediately curious about what happens to her. Blimey, she was going to get married. What now? So that's really what binds us to a story. Another good example is Neville Shute's novel On the Beach, which is about the last straggling survivors of a nuclear war. So on the one level, we've got intellectual curiosity, which is, how did it happen? What does the world look like? What will the end be like? How will people die? All those sorts of plotty things. But what Neville Shute also does, which is really clever, and which is why this novel, which was written in about several decades ago, it still endures, because he shows what it's like to be a person living under those conditions, knowing they will die and coping with that. And that's a huge difference. And it takes the story to a completely different level. The reader starts to feel they are experiencing it and they care about what happens next. And instead of thinking, how do these people die? They think, these people are like me and I don't know what I would do and I need to see. And that need pulls readers along with the story.
And I mean, a lot of people think, well, in a genre novel, you know, like a thriller or something, you know, does character really matter? But actually, I was just thinking of Jack Reacher, you know, Lee Child's Jack Reacher books. Now, they are totally genre thriller, you know, plot based, but everyone knows them as the Jack Reacher books. So is it that people also remember character more than story as such?
They do, because a character is their conduit. It's the person they're experiencing it through. And actually, writers have to work quite hard to make that connection. It doesn't just come naturally or automatically. You can't just watch people do stuff and then feel attached to them. So Lee Child will have gone to quite significant lengths to make sure that you made that connection. And it all comes down to seeing the character's humanity. And quite a good example of this is if you think of real life, because a lot of writing principles, storytelling principles, come from what just works in real life. Think of being on a crowded commuter train. You're squashed up against people, and they are all people, but you're not taking any notice of that. And you just are in your own cocoon. And it's easy to create characters who just don't really come alive as people. They're just a name on a page or a job description. And we need to kind of connect with something else in them. Something this makes me think of is when I was ghostwriting, I did one novel which was about hostage negotiations. So I had to learn how you persuade people who have taken a bunch of innocents captive and may be about to kill them, how you actually persuade them not to. And what negotiators in hostage situations do is they try to establish a relationship with the captors by working on their common humanity. And they sort of edge things into the conversation, just asking them about their families, their lives, their kids, the things they like doing. So they gradually build up they actually build up the hostage taker's sense that they are a human and that they are talking to another human and that they are all humans in this together. And good writers do exactly the same when they're creating characters like Jack Reacher. They will find what's in their hearts and souls that makes them like the readers.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And because we have a lot of listeners who also write non-fiction, and I actually wanted to just, you know, briefly talk about character in non-fiction, because what I find now is even in business books, I read a lot of business and entrepreneurial books, that people essentially use little stories, you know, in the beginning of most chapters. That's kind of become the norm. And so is character, you know, even in memoir, like you're the character and that type of thing. So is character important in any type of book, basically?
Oh, yes. I don't think you can go wrong if you send your book around people. And as you said, that is a growing trend now, particularly as business books try to cross into the more mainstream. So you get things like The Moral Molecule, or a friend of mine, Tim Harford, writes books about economics, in which he makes economics about life. And you can't go wrong, really, if you make your books about people and life. I mean, think of things like recipe books, Nigella Lawson, Jamie Oliver, and Nigel Slater. They all have a strong authorial voice, which is, here am I with you. This is how I do it. These are the things I like. And they build up a really strong persona that guides people through the book. And I did that, actually, with Naylor Novel, my first Naylor Novel book. I sort of created the sense of being a teacher there, holding the hand of the reader, which is what I do when I mentor people too. So it's a very good way of getting the reader to engage with you as the teacher and the persona and you know, their company, really. Any book you read, you are spending time in the company of the writer.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Okay, well, so some nitty-gritty questions, because there's so much in your book, it's really hard. So I thought I'd ask you, you know, a protagonist being whatever the main character is, that, you know, the main person in the book, what are the sort of top three things that people get wrong about protagonists, and how do they fix them, or how do they, you know, not get them wrong in the first place?
Am I only allowed three?
Goodness. Yeah, well, that's it. I just thought I'd better choose three, you know, otherwise that will be the only question.
Well, one of the hardest balances to strike is making the character likeable. And what I often find is that novice writers, they try very, very hard to create a saintly paragon who everybody likes, nobody dislikes, they can never do one bad thing. But often with their other characters, they're more relaxed. You know, they'll let them have a flaw or two, a bit of bad temper, like we all do, things that make them impatient. But with the main character, they think they've got to be brilliant and lovable. You have got to like them. But that actually makes the reader think, oh no, I can't stand this person. They are just too much. And anyway, it's humanity we connect with. If you think of the Hunger Games, Katniss, she's a strong protagonist. We follow her. But she isn't exactly that likeable. She's actually quite intolerant, prickly, bad-tempered. But we connect with her humanity and her sense of being in a very difficult situation. And she's got people she cares about and things that they drive her to do. And she's got her own impulses that she has to balance. And that makes us connect more. We kind of need to engage with some of the rough sides as well. So normally I think that even if you've got a protagonist who is thoroughly nice, and Katniss isn't thoroughly nice, but if you've got someone who is just, you know, yummy person you'd want to hug, they are in their comfort zone when they're being like that. And everybody is nice if they're in their comfort zone. So what you have to do is find places where they don't feel so capable or comfortable or at ease. And that's, I call it the discomfort zone. These are the places where they might get a little bit irritable or intolerant. There are things that get their goat. And that starts to show who they really are. And then further outside that, you can find places where they're really uncomfortable, which is a kind of, I call that the war zone. And you can really get characters to discover who they are. And that could be physical danger. It could be something like bereavement or any extreme situation, or it could be another person who brings out the worst in them. And that could be an antagonist, or it could be an actual villain. We'll talk about that later. But yes, there are ways that you can find even your nicest characters' weak spots. And that's very important. It goes a long way towards making the reader like them. Another big mistake is not plugging the reader into the character's internal life. So that means it's hard to understand what actually matters to them, because everybody needs something they want or something they want to prevent, because that drives the story. And that also makes them stick with the bad things that are going to happen rather than just give up. So early on, we need scenes that establish this and establish them as individual people. And usually a good way to do this is to find what frustrates them and makes them feel something's got to change, you know, maybe bored with life on their dull planet, or they wish they could grow up faster or solve a world problem. But often what the writer does is they'll show us a bunch of things happening that make the character exasperated, but they don't show us how the character feels about them. Now, usually while they're writing the scene, they're really immersed in it, and they're probably feeling the character's emotions, but they assume that we know how the character feels. So a very simple example, if the character gets fired from their job, and the writer might be thinking, everyone knows this is bad, everybody will understand the character feels crushed. But actually, there are 1,000 ways to feel about this situation. You might feel liberated, or fearful, or vengeful, or a mix of lots of those things. Now, which is it? And if you're including that scene to show us who the character is, we need to see what they felt. We don't need to guess at it, because we'll make the wrong guess. They might not feel as we do. Now, later in the book, you don't have to spell things out nearly so much. When we know the character better, we can intuit what they're feeling, and that increases our attachment to them, in fact, because we feel, I know how you feel. It doesn't have to be spelt out. But early on, if you don't show a reaction, the reader assumes that there wasn't one and that this didn't matter. And that's not what you want. So there's a real biggie. I see that so often. I'll be reading a passage and I'll think, I think this is supposed to be telling me something that really matters to this character, but there's no reaction. So it looks like it didn't. So
isn't that's kind of one of the you know, rules in inverted commas around scenes that they should either advance the plot or develop character.
Yes, certainly. It's if a scene does more than one thing, then that's great, because you feel that you've seen something very significant. And if every scene feels significant, then it pulls the reader along. It makes the book feel like it's moving fast. Mm. And another writing principle it illustrates is show, not tell, which people say all the time, and writers can never be told it often enough. I even have a post-it note on this monitor here, show, not tell, because it's easy to forget that we have to show the reader things, particularly why things matter to the characters. Mm. Well, and the third mistake, you wanted three, enigmatic characters. And we love to write about people who are strange or mysterious, but it's very easy to make them empty instead of mysterious because we don't want to show too much about them. We want to preserve this intrigue. But we have to show something to keep that intrigue. Now, we can't show their internal life, because if you show how these mysterious characters feel about things and what makes them tick on the inside, you've destroyed the mystery. Mm. But you have to show something. Again, what writers often do is just leave it blank. They don't show us anything about how the character is feeling about something. They're a complete blank face. Nothing is really registering or affecting them. But what's better, a better way to generate a mystery, is to make things that make the reader wonder if there's more there. And it's not by underdrawing them, it's by creating conundrums. So you might have dates that don't add up, or things that other characters do that don't make sense. Certainly show them responding to things, but never letting on what they feel. Mm. So they keep their cards close to their chest, but there are definitely a lot of cards there. So you have to give a sense of there being a lively consciousness and a big background that the reader wants to know about, but you don't actually show it from the inside.
Mm. I actually think, you know, when as you're talking, I'm thinking there's almost like a hierarchy of character that you do in, or that you see in books, and as a writer we kind of go through, you know, from the very basic genre type of novel where that character is important, but it may well be underneath the plot, you know, like you're talking about a mysterious character there, and that seems to me, you know, to be like a more what would you say, like an advanced character tip that you kind of get to. Well, I just say this from my perspective because I'm writing, you know, novel number 4 right now, you know, whereas you're on like 15 or something.
And, yeah, I think so.
And you kind of, you know, over time, I think you can get, you understand yourself more, so you can write into your characters more. So what do you think about that? I mean, do you think writers need to get deeper into themselves to write deeper into character?
That's a very interesting question, because we're often in danger of making characters who are carbon copies of us. And that's possibly because we can't see that there are actually a lot of ways that we could write from the inside of a character but create different characters. It's probably the easiest way to describe it is if you imagine there are lots of situations in life where we might be slightly different people. So you might have the mode that you draw on when you're doing a speech, and you might have another mode that you draw on when you're getting deep into the writing, and they both feel like quite different people. If someone gave you a questionnaire right now and said, okay, answer me the 10 things that are most important to you right now, they'd be different lists. And these are different ways you feel just by yourself. Now add other people to that mix and other situations, and you can actually tap into quite a few different ways that you yourself feel. So you behave differently perhaps with the older members of your family than your friends who knew you at college. And these are all little compartments that you can draw on to start making people who come from you but feel different from you. And they will have slightly different priorities, which from priorities you can build up what a character wants in a story and the things that matter to them. And so, yes, you can. The more you become aware of yourself and the different faces you present to the world, the more you can write different people with depth and insight.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So, I'm thinking about this kind of hierarchy and where it's happening with my writing is really that this time the character, quite different. I'm writing like a crime novel and, you know, with a detective, something I know absolutely nothing about. So there's a kind of load of research there as well. And her, you know, she has a daughter and, there's a death and so there's bereavement, stuff that's not me. So I wonder if you also, when we start writing, do we start by writing far more autobiographically and then as we develop we can actually start going further than that? And is there a problem with writing autobiographically if people are worried about that?
Oh, that's so interesting. I think we do start writing autobiographically. We start by thinking, and what has mattered to me. And then as we become more sort of flexible, it's like, I think, getting to learn an instrument. After a while, you begin to realise there are other places you could go imaginatively. Mm. And like bereavement, for instance, many of us may not have experienced it, but we could probably imagine what it might be like. And when you're writing people who do very bad things, and we're going to come on to this later, but there's another leap that you might have to take to understand what it feels like to be that person. But then I'm leaping ahead there, because I know we want to talk about that later. We often do start by putting a lot of our real selves as we see ourselves into books, and that can be quite inhibiting in a way, because we become aware of people who might read it and will be thinking, is that you?
Yeah.
Do you really feel like that?
Yeah, and for some reason it's more around the sex than the violence.
Oh goodness. Yes, it is, isn't it? Or are we? Is that just what we think?
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure it is.
But if your friend said, that was quite a sexual, actually, yeah, but I mean, I think I am, put the other way round. If people say to me, oh, that character of yours, he's quite sexy, I probably go red. On the inside, I definitely feel it. It just sort of feels like it's a thing that they've seen that's rather private. But when you're there with the page, I just think, what's right for these characters? What's right to keep people immersed in my story and in the truth of the experience, whatever I'm writing? And when I'm ghostwriting too, which is, you know, for me, I don't really ghostwrite in a literary way. They're far more sort of plot-based thriller type novels that I've written, but I'm still sort of trying to mine an experience and keep the reader, giving the reader really the experience that they want. They want to be in those shoes, and however, whether it's deeply literary or whether it's an adventure, they still want to be in the truth at the moment.
And I do think, you know, we talk a lot about research for novels in terms of ideas and, you know, plot and things, but I actually have ended up doing research for character emotions by, you know, for this bereavement, the death of a child, actually reading the blogs of women who, you know, mothers whose children had died, and, you know, which was awfully emotionally wrenching. But I felt that was, you know, you can't just research your character's physical traits, you know, by looking at movie stars. You do have to research an emotional level as well. Do you do that, or do you actually make it up?
Oh no, I gather memoirs and blogs as well of people who have been in situations that I'm going to be writing about. And there's one novel, it's a memoir I just read recently, Darren Strauss's book about having, he killed a girl by knocking her off her bicycle. I think he just learned to drive, and it stayed with him all his life. And I just wanted to understand what that was like. And it was feeding into something that I was writing. But yes, I get a lot of memoirs by people who have been in those situations, because that contact with their mind and emotions will let me start to live it. I think writers get very good at being emotional sponges and at understanding what it's like to be behind another person's eyes and to carry their soul for a little bit. And from that, we can come out, and then we can understand how they would react and the situations that might make their lives different from our own. So, yeah, that's a brilliant way of understanding the soul of somebody who's been through something quite different from you.
It's the first time I've been writing something and actually, like, cried myself. I was, like, weeping at my death scene. But it was interesting because it's the first time it's happened to me, and I think that's a real... I think I've been able to get far more into the character than I have before. So, because my other writing, and we'll talk about bad guys now, because in the past, like with my Arcane books, I've really enjoyed writing the bad guys. You know, in my last book, Exodus, I had a evil kind of woman who sort of has ritual sex and kills people in tombs and then blows people up and shoots people and beats people up. And, you know, that's really fun for me. But all of those things I just said are all kind of physical manifestations of quite boring evil, let's just say. You know, like, killing people is kind of an obvious antagonist. So what are the things people get wrong with the kind of the antagonist or the villain, you know, kind of side of things in that high genre versus kind of more normal life?
a memorable antagonist needs to be as well developed as your protagonist, because for a start they've got to be a proper match for them. They've got to be worth defeating, and they've got to be they've got to have enough staying power to create enough trouble. We should have a quick definition here, because it's easy to get mixed up. Antagonists are all villains are antagonists, but all antagonists aren't necessarily villains. An antagonist is just someone whose interests oppose your hero's, and they might be an ordinary person, just as nice as your hero, but they want something different. So a man on the run needs to evade the policeman who's out to arrest him. There's no evil there. They're both doing what they've got to do. A villain, though, intends real evil, and they have sort of a different set of rules that they live by, and they're often a brush at the dark side of humanity. And this makes them really fascinating to read about, and fascinating to write if you really delve into what drives them. As you've got murderers, psychopaths, con men, assassins, serial killers, and they are people want to know about this side of humanity that's not like what they get in their real life. But there are a number of ways that it goes wrong. The first major thing is that writers often make their antagonists act in isolation. It's as if they don't want to give their antagonist their own kind of home tribe. Now, protagonists will be surrounded by family, colleagues, supporters, friends, colleagues, yeah, everybody. The antagonist is on their own. Now, really, in real life, they would usually not be completely on their own. They might have organisations working for them. They might work within organisations. They might have henchmen. Even if they're loners, like the assassin in The Day of the Jackal, they need people from time to time. Tom Ripley, Patricia Highsmith's fantastic anti-hero, what will you call it? But he needs people from time to time. They're disposed of once they've outlived their usefulness. But still, they need people around them. And if they're an antagonist rather than a villain, they often have friends who believe in their cause. But I often see stories about, say, somebody battling their ex-wife. The ex-wife is on her own, lonely and miserable. And that's just not very realistic. So they've got to be realistic in lots of ways. And that's one way, one key way, in which they can be made more realistic. Another factor is strengths. Writers often don't want to give their antagonists any good characteristics, especially if they're out-and-out villains. But all antagonists are usually highly motivated, or they wouldn't be causing any problems. And the more villainous they are, the more likely they are to be very intelligent and original and inventive. Now, it might not be intellectual intelligence. It might be more an animal intelligence that's just so feral. It's sort of very difficult for a normal person like you and me to sort of resist them or overcome them because we couldn't do the things they do. But still, these are strengths. These are positive characteristics. And if you show these, you can make them far more memorable and scary. You make somebody who becomes a creature of nightmare. Rather than just someone who sort of kills somebody, they become someone whose motivations make you just shiver every time they're on the page, because you feel there's something about them, a darkness. And another thing following on from that is their motivation. Often writers want their villains to be simply evil, but evil's quite hard for a reader to grasp. But if we see why it's personal to the villain, we understand far more about what keeps them going and why they won't give up. Because actually villainy is quite an effort. It is. You're going to cause trouble. You're going to get in trouble. You know, all sorts of things might happen. The messes might be made, which you'll have to clear up. But they have to be motivated. Now, they might want to rule the world, or they might be doing what they're doing because they genuinely feel they can sort out the mess humanity's got themselves into, and they just need someone with a bit of backbone. But all these make a villain far more believable, because there's something inside them that's keeping them going rather than just the plot's convenience. And if there is absolutely nothing noble about them at all, if they're simply cruel and horrible, we still have to see why they keep doing it, because there is something that's keeping them going. Now, if they are just the kind of people who like to destroy for the sake of destroying, they are getting a kick out of it, because they're nothing without victims. If they don't have victims, there's nothing that's worth doing. So the victim makes it worthwhile for them. So what you have to do is show the kick they get out of it. This is very nasty indeed, isn't it?
I actually think writing villains can be a lot more fun, because maybe it's almost that when you're nice people like we are, you can actually really let your imagination go with villains, because it's not you can never be autobiographical unless obviously you're some kind of psycho killer, or that's in a thriller, for example. So you actually maybe you can let your imagination run more freely with a villain than you can do with a hero character. What do you reckon?
Yeah, certainly you can get far more interested in them, because once you start thinking, what do they get out of it? What's keeping them going? What are the rewards? You can go into endlessly fascinating places, but then you have to keep your own interest in the hero, and that comes from the things at stake for them and the dilemmas that they get presented with in order to go on the journey that they must go through. So there's like two different sets of equations. On the one hand, we're interested in the hero because we're thinking, what do they need to prevent? What are they protecting? What do they want to accomplish? What dilemmas has this put them into? What keeps them going? And they're quite often on the defensive, but we've got to be in there with them and thinking, this matters, and we've got to keep the reader thinking, this matters. And that comes from you as the writer feeling, this matters, I want to battle on. And on the other hand, we have the villain who is thinking, this is great, I'm inflicting cruelty and getting a kick out of these weaklings, or I'm getting further in my plan to make the world a better place because I'm the only person who can do it, and I don't know why everybody is so bothered by deaths.
and that can be so much more fun.
Well, it can be, but you've got two ways of having fun with your book in that case.
Saving the world and destroying it.
You have your hero whose cause you believe in, and you have your villain who you also see why they're doing it. So that creates a really absorbing place for you to be as a writer. And that all comes from understanding the people you've created.
Oh, absolutely. Now, one of probably the biggest issue I've had, and I still have, is dialogue. Because and this is probably the biggest difference I see between writing nonfiction and writing fiction, because I think I really believe that pretty much anyone who writes business documents at work could probably write a decent nonfiction book about something, just a how-to book or whatever. Because we know how to write sentences, we know how to put things together. But dialogue is something that you do not write in normal life. Like, even if you journal, you know, you write in your journal, you write business documents, you write letters, you don't write dialogue unless you write a novel. And I think, I mean, there are some people who get away with doing accents and who do regional stuff. I personally, I will put down a book if I see that, because I hate it. I hate reading all the kind of regional stuff or funny names that I can't pronounce in my head. That's why I can't read fantasy books, because they all have funny names. But so help us out on dialogue. What are some of your tips for getting it right?
Well, it's so interesting that you mention accents, because we do have to make the characters sound different from each other, and they've got to have their own voice. But that doesn't mean accents. It actually comes from within. It's more, they're different approaches to life. They're different backgrounds. A highly educated person might use more complex sentences with sub-clauses. A simpler soul might use short sentences with one idea per sentence. So their language will tell them to the reader to an extent who they are. Synonyms are very characteristic. So does your character say girlfriend, partner, bird, bit on the side, or trouble and strife? These are all very different ways to describe one thing. Mm. Synonyms are a very good way of creating your character's own vocabulary. Another way you can make them sound different from each other is by giving them different senses of humour. Mm. Something I really notice in manuscripts is where all the characters have the same sense of humour, because the writer has put in the things that they do to make people laugh, or to lighten the mood, or to make sort of light of something awful that's happened. But actually, people all have different ways of doing this. So if you've got a bunch of characters, a good way that you can make them have different personalities is just by making them differently humorous. Mm. So find different ways for them to be humorous. Also, if they curse or don't curse, this is all part of their personality. Some people would never say a naughty word at all. Some people say them all the time. And we all have favourite words that we use in stress situations. So all these can be used to build up your character's vocabulary without you ever having to put in funny accents, which I agree, they can be very difficult to read. You've got to be very, very careful.
Yeah.
And another thing you can do in dialogue is use non-verbal communication, because characters don't have to verbalise everything. Instead of answering a difficult question, they could shrug or look at their shoes.
That's what I'm aiming for now. That's exactly the tip that, you know, I would say to people, and it's where I've gone, is very much use the non-verbal as a way to demonstrate character, you know, and also emotion as well.
Definitely. So because if you try
less, and... Write it, don't
put too much non-verbal communication or stage directions in. But if you get to a stage where someone's had a shock and they can be shocked, have them just silent for a moment. Instead of trying to write, "I feel very shocked," often the writer doesn't know what to put, but that's actually because the person may not know what to say. So, yes, definitely use non-verbal communications. And you can also use those kind of directions to mean that you don't have to state quite so often, "he said," you know, "Joanna said," Ross said. And you can use those to do that work for you as well. Mm. And another thing you can do is keep the reader in the scene with the visual description as well. Often when we launch into a dialogue scene, the previous scenes will have been maybe quite visual. They've been describing, say, a sunny day, or, you know, me sitting in my office with a lamp beside me. But then the characters will start talking. All those visuals will disappear because the writer is suddenly thinking it's ears, it's all about noise. But actually it's not. You need to keep the reader in the other kind of details as well, or they'll suddenly feel there's been an abrupt gear change. So give some visuals. Say if there's a wedding reception, have a waiter pad up and sort of indicate the menu or something, someone would ask for it. Just something like that, a visual thing. Or you can add other oral details that keep the reader in the scene. So if you're on a spaceship, the burble of instruments on the flight deck. Mm. Or if there are two of you crossing the desert on camels, take a beat to describe the steady pad of the camel's feet as they're undergoing the swing of the animal's back. to keep us in the scene as though there was no dialogue there. Mm. And another thing to really be aware of is the character's relationship with each other. And this is really interesting. We could get into sort of quite deep levels of what dialogue can do. But at the most basic level, many dialogue scenes can look very flat because we don't have a sense of how the characters are responding to each other's status according to their roles in the book. So you might have a king talking to his prime minister. There are certain things that the prime minister, you're just going to have to go along with it because it's the king he's talking to. Mm. And his language, his demeanour should all reflect that. And it's particularly interesting if you want to show a switch in status. So you could begin with the king starting off by being in charge and giving orders, but then the prime minister says something that means he suddenly gains control. Mm. And he's the one who's dictating terms. And that can be very interesting. These switches in status can keep a reader feeling there are real developments going on all the time. So you might apply that to almost any situation. Somebody says something and it tips the balance of power between these two people. Mm. So this is going on under the dialogue. This is under what they're saying. It's their emotions and it's how they're reacting to each other. So be aware of the souls in the room, people there.
Yeah, wow. You know, and it's I think the more you know, like you say, we could talk about this forever, and there really is so much. But we are out of time. So I wondered if you would, because the book is full of stuff. I wondered if you could briefly, you know, give us an overview of what people can find in the book.
Well, I wrote it from all the, because I've been assessing manuscripts for about 20 years alongside all the writing that I've been doing. And what I wanted to do was create a book that would help people with the problems that I've found they've had creating characters and getting us involved with them and making the reader sort of feel they know them and want to follow them. Mm. So there's a lot about when the reader can fill in the blanks and when you mustn't let them fill in the blanks. Mm. And when they do fill in the blanks, this increases their attachment to the character. So it's a very important thing to learn how to do. I've also written about how to write the opposite sex. So a lot of people are worried about writing men if they're women and vice versa. So I tackled that. How to write teenagers. Oh, yes. That was really interesting to research.
Yeah, I imagine.
Various stages at which the changes happen and how it makes the characters feel. Mm. But also how you don't want to end up with a caricature, because it's very easy to just write somebody who's bad-tempered and wears black. But teenagers can be really interesting. Even if you're not writing young adult, you might have teenage characters who you can use in ways that you can't use fully adult characters. So that's quite an interesting thing to have in your armory. Mm. Another point I've gone into is characters in dystopias, how you write people in situations where the society is perhaps what you're more interested in than the characters, but it's how you create characters who will do that job for you and will get the reader interested in your society. And also characters who are symbols. Often we want sort of quite symbolic roles for some of our characters. So there are whole ways to do this that work really well. And there are also ways you can muck it up and just make them cardboard cutouts. Passive characters. This is something that's a real problem for many writers. They create a hero who, as you said, isn't as interesting because they're having stuff happen to them all the time, but they actually need to do more to solve that. And it's a really big problem I find with manuscripts. The central character is passive, but there are ways that you can make them into far more interesting and invigorating heroes while not making them swashbuckling. They can still be ordinary people.
I love swashbuckling.
You can buckle your swash if you like, but not everybody will be like that. Sometimes they'll just be an ordinary person who's been thrown into an awful situation. It's how to tackle that. I've also written a lot about relationships. Friends, family, including awkward bits like sex and stuff, and development games and questionnaires and exercises that will help you populate a novel and make the characters into three-dimensional people. Mm. And all the time I address what's right for the genre that you're writing, because literary novels need a whole different kind of dimension from a straightforward adventure story. And also stories for different age ranges too. You won't go into as much detail in a middle grade book as you would for a sort of very considered book for adults. So all that's in there.
Fantastic. So give us the title again and where people can find it.
It's called Nail Your Novel, Bring Characters to Life. And it's on all the ebook platforms, and it will shortly be in print as well. You can, if you want to find it, the best place to start is my blog, Nail Your Novel. And I've got a little tab there that will show you links to all my books and where you can find them.
That's fantastic. And we also have a multimedia course together, don't we?
We certainly do, yes.
We do. How to write a novel.
All our expertise, mine 20 years worth of doing it and helping people to do it, and yours starting from scratch and figuring it out.
Yeah, that was really fun to do, because I did feel, you know, I feel like when you're at the beginning, and I'm sure some people listening just, you know, don't have, maybe writing their first novel or, you know, were just starting out, you actually have a completely different mindset than someone like yourself who's so, you know, so experienced now, and you've written so much and you've read so much. So if you're interested in that, it's at thecreativepen.com/write-novel, and you can find out about that. But otherwise, yeah, so people can find all your stuff at nailyournovel.com. Is that right, Rod?
That's right, yes. And they can also find me on Twitter at nailyournovel.
Everywhere, nailing Everywhere. Novels.
Yes, just nailing.
In general. And thanks ever so much for your time, Rod. That was great.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So thanks to Ros Morris for a great interview, and also thanks to Audible.com who sponsored the show today. And remember, you can get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial by signing up at audiblepodcast.com/thecreativepen, and that's pen with a double N. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.